Armstrong frequently talked about the benefit of reading biographies and learning from the lives of other people. This morning, in this period of time, I'd like to talk to you about one very famous American, namely Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was, to my mind, one of the great pioneers of the land of America, and I'd like to use his example this morning by way of acknowledging this day in particular. That's right, that'll be great. Nothing like a bit of Lego to compete. It's the very thing. I can't hear myself. I'm sure you can't hear. Abraham Lincoln was born in 1809 in a log cabin in the state of Kentucky. His father was a farmer, and his grandfather was killed by the Indians. So you have a scene being set of a farming stock from a very difficult background. But Abraham Lincoln, if you like to think of the times as being pre-television, was very good at telling stories. There was no telephone, no television. You could read, and you could develop your personality in a way that was right. And he was very good at telling stories. To read, and he read widely. In fact, his prime source of reading was the Bible. His secondary source were the classics, and Mills and Boone had not yet been invented. So he read what we might call respectable literature and profitable material. He worked at many jobs and had lots of experience in life, but he had mostly great experience with people. And he decided to study law. So he read and studied law by himself. Think about doing that today. He read and studied law by himself. He only had 1 year of formal schooling. 1 year. The rest was self-taught. And you think of the energy that would go into a man to be self-taught to that level, to be able to cope with life and reach the highest office in the land. So you can imagine that Abraham Lincoln was extremely ambitious. Yes, he was. He was very, very ambitious. But he wasn't stifled by the schooling system, which is interesting to reflect upon. So although he was ambitious and he chose to go into politics, he remained a very humble individual. One very famous quote he gave was this. He said, quote, "So long as I have been here, I have not willingly planted a thorn in any man's side." That's quite a comment for a political leader, showing a concern with people. And I would think it would be a man few and far between that would be able to say that, in fact, in reality today. Anyway, I liken him a little bit to Churchill, who also did not go to university and yet reached the highest office in the land. So Abraham Lincoln didn't go to university, he was self-taught, and if you think about it, nor did Mr. Armstrong go to university. A lot of the great men of our past did not go through formal schooling in a strict sense of the word. Well, that isn't that it's wrong, it's just a matter of what is your driving motivation and where do you propose to take the knowledge that you have, what do you propose to do with it. So frequently Abraham Lincoln was in the political wilderness. No one wanted him. He didn't fit. His ideas were wrong with the times, or he was too honest, or whatever it may have been. But he thought very deeply about life, and his philosophy was to succeed, you had to work, then work some more, and then work some more. That was his philosophy on success. Work, work, work. And he believed in applying the intellect that he had to practical solutions for problems as they presented themselves. And he always prided himself on seeking justice and right solutions. When he was a lawyer, a practicing lawyer, if his client lied to him, he dropped the case. He no longer would proceed on their behalf. Now that, I don't think you'd find today. Or at least, I suspect it will be rare today. But that was the character of the man. And I, in a sense, feel that God used him as a judge over Israel because of that quality and character which he had. He said, for instance, that in his time, if man didn't solve the problems of his time, man would be extinct in 100 years. Well, he wasn't right on the time, but he certainly got the trajectory right, that we are trying as desperately as we can to extinguish ourselves. An unusual comment, perhaps, for that age and for that generation. Abraham Lincoln was very famous as a speaker. He was good, as I said, at telling stories, and he became very good at the political meetings, the hustlings, or the soapboxes, or the stump meetings, of getting up and extemporaneously speaking on whatever subject you care to mention. Full of facts, lots of dates he could recall, and very witty as a speaker, and quite a comment. In fact, in 1860, the New York Tribune newspaper said he was the greatest speaker since the time of St. Paul. That's quite a comment. He was a very powerful speaker in his day. Of course, none of us have heard him, more's the pity, but a very great and powerful speaker. The great problem, of course, at the time was the slave situation in America, which divided the nation and brought about the Civil War. There were other issues, but slavery was the real cause and concern, a big social situation. And he talked about action, not words. And he talked about being a doer. I'd like to read what it says in James 2 about keeping the law. James 2, or at least refer to it, and verse 10. James 2, verse 10, it says, "Whosoever shall keep the whole law," in other words, try to be right in all directions and angles, "and yet offend in one point, well then he is guilty of all." So Abraham Lincoln tried as best he could to make sure that whatever he did was right in all aspects of the law and not just in one particular area. Well, that was his approach. Later on, more into our generation and time, Winston Churchill said, "If speeches won wars, I'd have beaten Hitler a long time ago." But speeches didn't win the wars, action did. And of course, Lincoln was of the same mold, that you had to have action, not just speeches. Anyway, America was split. The Civil War came along. Lincoln represented the North with the Union forces. And then in the South, we had the Confederate forces. And good old Ephraim naturally backed the loser and was siding with the South, with the Confederate side of things. During the war, 500,000 people died, which for those days was a considerable loss. The cream of the nation, 500,000 gone. Many, many famous generals came through that period of time, which you might remember. One man was very famous. His name was General Burnside. And he became famous because he had whiskers right down the side of his face. And that was the origin of sideburns. General Burnside was the originator of sideburns. There's one more thing we have to thank the Americans for. They come and go, don't they? And was it the early 70s we had sideburns in this country? Somewhere in the early middle 70s they were in, mutton chops and things. And then bit by bit the fashions change again. General Grant was another very famous man. Not to be confused with a whiskey from Scotland, but General Grant was extremely able and very capable. Lincoln supported him greatly. Sometimes he used to get drunk. He had a drop of the Grants a little now and again. And some of his fellow officers would complain to Lincoln about General Grant. And they would say he wasn't fit to hold office. And Lincoln used to say, "If I knew what brand of liquor he drank, I would send all my other officers a barrel of the same stuff." So he didn't condone drunkenness, but he did appreciate the battles which General Grant was able to win. But when he was sober, he was a good general, and he was on target. Many's the man that, if you like, had to overcome his drink problem. In fact, in this country of more recent time, Robert Hawke had to put aside the bottle to succeed in high office. and that would not be the first time that's had to occur. Later on, we see another general, probably the greatest general that they produced at the time, was General Robert E. Lee, reckoned by historians to be the most able general they had. Unfortunately, he was on the wrong side. He was on the South, the Confederate side, and one of the reasons he agreed to surrender was because he knew that Abraham Lincoln would treat the loss or the losing side fairly. So that motivated him greatly to acknowledge that if he would be dealt with fairly, the people would be, then he would surrender to Lincoln. This is the time of the song, John Brown's Body Lies a Moulding in the Grave. Do they still sing that in schools today? They used to. I've lost touch. He was a man that was opposed to slavery, formed a little army, and got himself hung for the process. He was... And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And they said that was a weak speech. But it became one of the more famous speeches of history. I imagine many in America memorized it, or had to, or chose to. And it's, although short, and I wouldn't read the full version, I just read parts of it. Although it was a short speech, nonetheless it showed the character of the man, and he became a classic. I would say then of Abraham Lincoln, he represented all that was good and right and fine about the original founding of America. And what he represented and stood for was a marvelous beginning to any nation. And words like the Gettysburg Address should be remembered for the remainder of our histories and our people. A total humanitarian, concerned for all people, a great man of history, and I believe we all should learn from examples of men such as that. So I think if we value independence, and I suppose we take it for granted, but if we value independence that God has granted to us, then the very least we can do is on July the 4th remember that the free peoples of this world owe a great deal to the forefathers that had the foresight and the character and the knowledge to do something about it and put action with their words. Nonetheless, when I look at the world today and our peoples, to me, we're still subject to slavery. I think independence is marvelous, but I wonder how many people really, really feel independent. I think we're pretty much under the bondage of slavery to this day. Many people still live on the breadline. We have not eradicated poverty. That's 200 years plus gone. We have social welfare schemes which keep people alive. But I'm not sure that that is a godly thing. I think that's a man-made idea. Because we give people handouts, but we don't ask them to work in return. I think we destroy people's pride and self-esteem. I don't think we have the answer. We think we're doing the right thing, but I don't think we are. Back in 1930, we began to give dole money out in England. I don't know when it started in this country, but it was 1930 in England. And yet I think slavery is still around because we see people that are pressured. We see people that are stressed. And we see people who are financially burdened. Few of us are landowners, but originally I think we're all intended to be landowners. Few of us are farmers. In fact, farmers are often despised or ridiculed or made fun of, but yet they're an essential part of life. In fact, comparatively few of us are self-employed. Most of us work for somebody else. In one sense, I consider that a mark of failure. Why would you want to spend the rest of your life working for somebody else? It's not wrong, don't misunderstand me. But it's a system. It's a culture. It's a world that we're in. But was it meant to be that way? Are you independent if you work for somebody else? I'm not so sure that you are. I don't all rush off out and resign, that's not what I'm saying. But on a broader issue, I'm not so sure that we're as well off as we think we are. And there's no nation which is as strong as its common man. The common working man is what makes the nation great, it's what makes it strong. You might put somebody into high office who tells them what to do, but it's the working man that produces the wealth that makes the nation what it is. And we're so heavily taxed because our governments have not known what to do that I believe if they could, they would tax the air you breathe. If they could think of a way of doing it, I think they would do that. They would tax anything they feel they can get their hands on, to more money to squander and waste in some other direction because it's not theirs. And they have no great respect for it. So I think it's good, whilst we think of independence, at the same time to realize that we as a people came out of Egypt a long time ago. Our forebears left the land of Egypt. They came out of what we would mentally imagine slavery to be, where you are told to work and you do as you're told. And I'm not so sure it's vastly different. There's nothing new under the sun. Some of us are probably prisoners of our own system that we've got ourselves into. Let me read to you what the civil law said back in Exodus 21. There's some interesting little snippets that you could pull out of the scriptures from time to time, which we tend not to read today, or we tend not to be using today, because our culture is different. But in Exodus 21, and also chapter 22, but 21 in particular here, you'll probably see more ifs than anything else. Virtually every verse has got if, if, if. A lot of ifs. It's as though God has seen it all before. Been there, done that, seen it, understood. Well, here we've got a civil law, which in one sense today reads a little awkwardly. But I'm not so sure that we're as well off as they were. Exodus 21, now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, and that means not that you can go out and buy someone, it means if he owes you money and defaults, i.e. goes bankrupt. If you buy a Hebrew servant, after 6 years of serving you, he goes free. Try that today. It's not so easy. Well, I know you can go bankrupt today and after 3 years or whatever it is, you might clear your name. But it's not the same. It's not the same. This was where you had to return. If you borrowed money and it all went sour, you had to go and work for that person. You weren't let off. You had to go and work for him to reproduce what was lost. And then after a given period of time, you were free to go. You worked for the period of time, as it states here, for the 6 years. And it was an interesting approach. You could only do this to males. You couldn't buy and sell females in the Hebrew society of the time. It goes on to talk about in verse 3, if he came in by himself, that's to say into this situation, he got himself into a pickle, shall we say. If he came in by himself, he should go out by himself. If he's married, then his wife goes out with him. But if while he's in this bondage or repayment of debt, if he has a wife and daughter, when he goes out, they don't go with him. You think that's hard? Well, he didn't have to marry. He could have waited till his 6 years were up and then married. There's a lot of different principles you can learn through this. about management of time, of money, of energy, of resources. And verse 5, if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master and my wife and my children, I will not go out, then he could become a slave for life. But he could have waited. He didn't have to get married. I think there's some lessons of economics that come through in that particular chapter, and it's interesting to read. To me, when you first read that, it sounds dreadful. It sounds like a pretty tough society. But I think on reflection that probably they were better off than we are today, because you went out free and you went out back to your inheritance, as it were, and you could get on with your life. So the problems could be resolved, whether they were marriage problems or whatever it might be. You could ask yourself another big issue that comes from it. Why did God allow slavery? Ask yourself the question, why did God allow it? He didn't want slaves. That's not what he intended. So what was it meant to teach them? What were the lessons to come out of it? Let me read to you in Leviticus chapter 25. It was meant to teach about life. It was meant to show you that as you grew up, you couldn't just walk through life and not be responsible. You couldn't just take on burdens that were wrong. You had to be able to produce in the right way, and you had to work hard. Leviticus 25 and verse 35, just picking up on a passage through here, it says, if your brother is poor and falls into decay, then you shall relieve him, yes, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. So there's a poor system. Take you no usury of him or increase. Ah, I see a transition from that to today, don't you? And how? A stranger or your brother? You can relieve him, you can help him, but don't take any usury or increase. Wow. I mean, it's fashionable to knock the banks today. But if you were to quote this to the banks, they would say, well, how would we survive? But fear you God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not give him the money upon usury, nor lend him your food for increase. So if you gave him food, or if you gave him a start or a kickstart or a helping hand, you didn't charge interest. If you think about it, that would give the man a chance to get going. See, what does the system we have to do with today? Say you're a young couple and you want to get married and start a family. How are you going to pay off a home? Well, if you've got double income and you're prepared to put by your family for a while, and you're prepared to commit yourself to slavery for 25 or 30 years, called a mortgage, you might get there. And you'll pay for that house two or three times over. Is that a really good system, or is that slavery? I know it's what we've got. It's what we're used to. But you see, they were used to making bricks in Egypt too at one time. They got used to that, and it became their life. And they got up in the morning and said, ho-hum, it's bricks again today. It's off to work we go. Well, it's ho-hum for us because it's off to pay the mortgage again. What's the difference? But on the other hand, if you had a system like this, where the government said, you're a young couple, you're getting married, right, we'll give you an acre, and we'll give you $10,000, and you can go and build your own home. Wouldn't that be a better way to get things going? Wouldn't that produce more? We've never tried it, though, have we? And he says in verse 38, I am the Lord your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. And if your brother that dwells with you is poor and be sold to you, i.e. redeemed in that particular sense, and we're talking about Israelites here, you shall not compel him to serve you as a bond servant. And there were different rules for different situations, whether you were Israel or whether you were a Gentile in that way. And they did have some slaves. Again, it wasn't necessarily what God intended, but they went on to do some of those things. It was just simply a point of taking a lesson from that particular section of verses to say that really what often kills us today is the greed of people that's brought about by interest rates. And you know, until recently a credit card was what, 24%? And some store cards were 30%? And what does that tell you? Does it tell you that they're greedy? They want a pound of flesh? Or does it tell you that we're greedy because we went to buy it and we didn't need it in the first place? So you get the two camps. The bank says, well, it takes us that money to service the situation, and that the consumer group says, cut up your credit card, chop it up, throw it away, live without it, go without, don't spend 25% or whatever it might be on a return. But it's all greed. Whichever side of the fence you're sitting on is based on greed, and the interest rates are really quite crippling. They're quite damaging. You know yourself, if you're paying off a mortgage, if it drops 0.5%, it makes a difference to your budget. Will you imagine if it was 10% knocked off? Or if you were given a loan that was interest-free? How soon would you pay your house off? How soon would the nation progress? And how things might be turned around in a different way of looking at it because of a different section of financing. Well, they finance themselves somehow. There are other ways of doing it. But we wind up with a situation, I suppose, with people, you cannot legislate human nature. Greed and avarice are very much in evidence. And what we've read there in Leviticus and Exodus was, don't charge increase, don't charge interest. Don't do it. So we do it. I call that financial irresponsibility. I think that's the basic problem. People are financially irresponsible, whether they're loaning or whether they're borrowing. There's irresponsibility both ways. Someone here defined the science of economics this way. Economics is the science of learning how to break all the principles of sound financial management without having to pay the penalty for it. I think that's fairly accurate. It's cynical, but it's accurate for our generation. Economics is the science of learning how to break all the principles of sound financial management without having to pay the penalty for it. You can disagree. You're free to do that. That's my perception. And I feel it's that way because I don't see fruits of sound financial management. I see chaos, and I think people are essentially in bondage. In modern day slavery. I don't think they're free. I don't think they're independent. If every one of us owned a 5-acre lot with a couple of cows and a fence and a little stream going through it, you'd say, well, this guy's up in cuckoo land. He thinks the millennium's come. But you see, we don't have independence. Everyone wants something else. Everyone wants more. You give a man 5-acre lot and soon he wants a 10-acre lot. And his poor neighbour down the road, he buys him out. And then he has a 50-acre lot and there's three guys on the street. And you move that one along a little further and you get a guy with a 1,000-acre lot and 50 guys on the street looking for work. What do? Well, they turn to crime. And the cycle continues because there's greed. And they don't help their brother out. They just make more for themselves. And the financial irresponsibility, I'll show you another example of it from 2 Kings chapter 4. It's just a little snippet. You wonder why it's there. 2 Kings chapter 4. This is even within the ministry. 2 Kings 4. Lessons throughout the Bible. And it begins by saying, there cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets. All right, a wife of a minister, if you like. She cried out unto Elisha. And she said, your servant, my husband, is dead. So she's a widow, a ministerial widow. And you know that your servant did fear the Lord, but the creditor is come to take unto him my two sons to be a bondman. He died with a debt. Then or now? What is free? Who really is independent? So Elisha goes to help her and fix up the situation and performs a miracle to solve the problem. But the woman was about to lose her two sons into paying off the debt. They didn't just go to a court and say, I'm bankrupt, that's it, and walk out and start another company. They had to physically go there and work till the debt was repaid. That's a different approach. You rarely find that today. Or you can look in Matthew 18. Matthew 18, and look, I think some of these are just different societies, different cultures, different times. In some senses they're idyllic, and in the sense of what God intended, some of these things just flat don't work today. The law doesn't allow for it. Just that simple. Matthew 18 and verse 23. Therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened unto a certain king which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought to him which owed him 10,000 talents, which today you might call $45 million. All right, well, that's the sort of guys that run off to Spain, isn't it, and get back trouble. Or whatever. But forasmuch as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold. See, you can't do that today, can you? But there was a time you could do that, where a man had to honour these things to a greater degree. He commanded him to be sold, and his wife, and the children, and all that he had, to make payment. The law doesn't allow that today, and we really think we're advanced. But I'm not so sure that we are. I'm not saying you can go back to this. I'm just saying here's what the Bible is allowing for. Anyway, that's the situation. You can read on and see about that. But the people got into trouble then. They get into trouble now. There's all sorts of things that can happen. I would say most nations are bankrupt, if you want to get right down to it. Even America, in its great independence, is borrowing money from Japan and Germany today. They've been doing it for several years now. They're borrowing. They're moving into a great debt situation. You know, during the Falklands War, the inflation rate in Argentina was 3,500%. Did you catch the noughts? 3,500% per year in Argentina. People didn't die, no more than normal. Just meant that your potato crop was worth more than it was last week. I mean, the figures. What do you do with them? What would happen in this country if all of a sudden the inflation rate wasn't 8% but was 800%? What would happen? Well, the pollies would all be gone for a start, wouldn't they? And there'd be somebody else in there saying, I can solve the problem. And no one would believe him, but they'd give him a go anyway, because that's the cycle we're locked into. And you say, and you might think we're independent, we're free. Are we? I don't know that we really are. I'm not so sure that we're free at all. We're probably about one of the poorest nations in Asia, if you're talking about the with-it nations, I mean the ones that think they're in the first world. We're probably about as poor as you can be. In Exodus 22, I should have said keep your finger in Exodus, but I imagine you'll find it again. In Exodus 22, that was the other chapter that was full of ifs and possibilities. Exodus 22, and just picking up on verse 1. I've not read the whole chapter, but you can if you like sometime. If you marked all the ifs in these two chapters, it would be virtually every verse. If, in chapter 22 and verse 1, a man was to steal an ox or a sheep, or today it might be your motor car or the possessions from your home, which happens all too frequently, and if he took this ox or this sheep and he killed it and he sold it, he would have to restore 5 oxen for one and 4 sheep for one. You imagine if your motor car was stolen and it was an honourable society and it was a rare thing, shall we say, or not hundreds a day like it is today, but say your car was stolen and they found the thief and he had to give you 5 more cars. And it wasn't just a thing that was set, but he actually had to work and you garnished his wages, or he worked for you until he paid off 5 more cars, up to 6 years. Would he steal again? Or would he think twice? That would be the question, wouldn't it? He may not be quite so rash and so hasty next time. What happens today? Well, we pat him on the head, put him in a little prison maybe if we want to, give him a colour TV, 3 meals a day. In fact, in some cases, they're better off than you and I. In some cases, they're better off. In some parts of the Western world, it costs $200 a day to keep men in prison. It'd be cheaper to give them $1,000 and put them on the street. But you and I don't earn that. But the thief, the criminal, can be in effect given that. Warmth, shelter, meals. Hey, that's not bad. It's got a wall around it, but no one's free anyway, so who cares? It's dangerous on the road, so I may as well stay in this compound. Go out there, there's crooks. Stay in here, it's safe and warm. Get my visits. The way it can be with some people, it's an extreme. But if he had to pay back 5 cars or 4 cars or 2 bicycles or whatever it was, he might be a little hesitant about doing it again. So in other words, what the Bible is saying is that crime shouldn't pay. But I think in this world crime does pay. I believe it pays handsomely. And we probably never will ever have enough policemen on the streets, because crime definitely pays. So in other words, there are different sides to the story, but some men simply couldn't handle their affairs well, and they got into trouble. And sometimes they had to be rescued from the particular problem they were with. Well, God's law teaches us to think, to plan, and to be careful. Ecclesiastes 10 tells us about money. Ecclesiastes 10 talks about money. And isn't that the bottom line for all of us? Money? Isn't that what it really is about? What do you work for? You work because you love the boss, right? Or you work because you're going to get paid. And you need to have money because you want to feed your face and feed your family and put clothes on your back. So you go to work for the money. Money. Money makes the world go round. Ecclesiastes 10 verse 19, money answers all things. You better believe it. There's lottos galore. You can't walk into a shopping mall today. There aren't at least 2 cars parked somewhere that for a $2 ticket you might win. When I came here a few years ago, it was 1 car parked in the mall some weeks. Now you go into some malls, there are 3 cars. All different lotteries. Every week. Places crawling with them. And people walk by and say, I wouldn't mind that. You buy a ticket along with 3 million other people and you might. You might. Or as some cynics said, they probably no one wins it. They just use the same car and keep going around Australia. No one actually wins. Who knows? Who cares? They all think they're doing something good. But money answers all things, Ecclesiastes tells us. And back in chapter 7, that was chapter 10, back in chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes, in verse 12, it says, money is a defense. You better believe that's true too. It sure is. It can buy you a lot of things, money. It's a great defense. On the other hand, when you read 1 Timothy 6, it tells you it can lead you into evil. That's also true. 1 Timothy 6:10. But money's a defense. It's a bit like the ad on TV. Don't leave home without it. That's a credit card or something, isn't it? American Express. Don't leave home without it. You know, the average American carries $39.32 in his pocket every day. I'm sure you want to know those sort of things. They're very valuable things to know. $39 in his wallet every day. Well, I don't know what we carry in our wallets as an average every day. Probably a good deal less. Zero some days, $5 some days, a few cents other days, maybe a $100 bill now and again, when it's not on the way to paying usury somewhere else. That's usually where it's headed, to somebody else's pocket. So money can lead to evil. That's what Timothy is, what Paul said to people of that time. But wisdom and discretion is really what you're learning as you read, whether it's Ecclesiastes or Exodus or Timothy. We're reading about wisdom, about discretion, about what we can really afford, about what we really need. I mean, do you dream about owning a Rolls Royce? Some do. If that's your goal, you can go for it. They're not that expensive. There was one in the paper last week for $28,000. Second hand, of course. Well, that's the price of an average car today. Trouble is, when the vanity's worn off, it's just four wheels and a chassis that gets you from A to B. And it's too big to get in the parking lot. And it costs a fortune in petrol. And so you see, you wind up with the dreams remain dreams, and the vanities remain the vanities of life. Better to dream, perhaps, than become a slave. Better to tailor according to our real needs than become burdened. Mr. Armstrong talked about simplifying your life. Maybe another way of putting it is don't get into too much debt. Don't burden yourself with things that you don't really need and want. 25 years of a mortgage, well, look, most of us have to do it. It's the system. It's the culture. There's no real alternative to it unless you inherit a lot of money. That's the way it is. I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying I think it could have been better. I'd like it to have been better. But in Proverbs, it tells us the truth of the issue. In Proverbs 22, let me just read to you what it says in Proverbs 22 and verse 7. It says, "The rich rules over the poor." Well, you wouldn't have to be that smart to realize that, would you? But it's in God's word as well. And the borrower is servant to the lender. That's the truth. That's the way it is. So as you go through life, if you want to be independent, then try not to burden yourself. Try not to get into colossal debt. Perhaps reduce your lifestyle where possible, where it's realistic. Or at least use wisdom. I don't know if it's possible for the average man to get ahead by borrowing money. I don't mean, well, borrow for your house, yes, or borrow for a car, major items. I think after the house and after the car, the third largest purchase you ever make is your carpet. Although up here in Queensland, often the carpet comes with the house. So you may never realize that. But you re-carpet a house and you're up for big bucks. There's a colossal involvement in that. But in terms of, say, speculation, I don't think the average man will get ahead by speculating today. Unless you've got a wizardry of a mind with finance, you can wheel and deal in some particular way. I think we've seen it through the 80s that it's incredibly difficult because greed took over. All the great entrepreneurs of the 80s, what was the real problem with them? Greed. They weren't content with a business that was successful. They had to get more and more and more and more. And they overspent. And I think the average man on the street could have told you they'd go bust. The average man could have told you that when he watched what they were doing. When they borrowed huge amounts, colossal amounts, and people could see what was happening. So it's a matter of perhaps living with the situation and allowing the fact that nothing is new. And in the old days, God said, well, if you get out of hand like that, you become a slave. You pay it off. And when you sorted that out, you have another go. And the worst you go for is 6 years as a slave. And then you kick off again. And you probably get there. And you probably learn. And throughout the course of your 70 years, if you had a couple of years or a couple of periods of slavery for 6 years, probably by the time you're 40 or 50, you've got it together. And you've worked a few things out. And you've left something for your kids that's worth having, a little more tangible. So people can always ask. I'll read you what it says in Luke, chapter 19 of Luke. There's an analogy between the church and money, which I think is interesting. And I use it in the sense of learning, life's an apprenticeship, seeking counsel. And Luke 19 and verse 12, it says, "A certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. He called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said to them, 'Occupy till I come.'" Now, you'll be familiar with this. And there are different stories you can get out of it. And it goes through to about verse 26. "But the citizens hated him, and the message after him is saying, 'We will not have this man to reign over us.'" But without reading the whole story through, I want you to look at it and think about it from a viewpoint of saying this could be read as the church and handling money, or me as an individual, or my responsibility toward money, and what I might do about that. If I was given 10 pounds, or 5 pounds, or 1 pound, what did I do with it? You can read it in terms of talents, but also money. And if you're earning so much a week, what do you do with it? Back in the 60s and the 50s, we had what they called a 6 o'clock swill in this country, which has since died out in many respects with the change of laws. But there are some people don't handle what they've got very well. And it wouldn't matter to me the amount you've got, but there's a principle involved. And one thing I'd like to leave as a result of reading that parable in your minds will be this. Learn the principle of saving. Now, a mortgage is saving, and there are other things in life that are saving, but just simply a cash asset to save, whatever your net income is, if you took, say, 5%, it could be more, it could be less, if you took 5% and you simply put that away as a savings account, be it ever so humble, nonetheless, it is teaching a principle that you can glean from the passages and the parables of Scripture, whereby you are in a role of not becoming greedy and not overspending and living within your means. And I think there are some great parallels there that we can learn from God, because our peoples traditionally have always led themselves into slavery. That's all we ever seem to do, is walk and run through greed and lust into slavery. And it's quite a tragedy. So as a principle, I would say if we could save something, it would be good. It would be a good example to leave to the young, to our children, and to leave it at that. So the slave learnt. And the interesting thing I felt about the first few verses of Exodus 21 was, what appeared very hard was, should you have been a slave and you married as a slave, you had to leave your wife and kids behind. And I said to myself, what was God telling us? And what he was saying was, if you meet a nice young lady while you're in a state of depression and poverty, don't marry. That's what he was saying. And when you've finished your 6 years and you're a free man again, then marry. That's what he was saying. What's wrong with that? What's wrong is our culture says, I want it now. That's what's wrong with it. Whereas God said, wait, be patient, it will come. And to think there's the truth of the issue will come. So you have to keep your mind on the goal, whether it was marriage and planning for it, whether it was a house and saving for it, or paying off a mortgage or whatever it might have been. You had to plan and you had to be willing to wait. Or if you wanted a flash car, you had to be able to work and save and earn that. And all of these things were part of life. If you married in haste through greed or lust, you could wind up like Samson. Samson was determined to marry Delilah. His parents said, don't do it, son. He said, I want to. What happened? Where did he wind up? He wound up in slavery. That's how he wound up, a slave. There's a great lesson in that. And he was a man of God. It happens to all, large, small, rich or poor. There are principles, there are lessons, there are thoughts about independence, about freedom, that some simply don't get. And for Samson, it meant his death. He went into slavery and he chose to die in that mode because there was no escape. And so he died the honourable way, in the slave mode. But it was a very sad ending and a very salient lesson to people. So the main thing in life, I suppose you'd say, is to qualify. Proverbs 29 says, without vision you perish. So we want to maintain, as it were, the right attitude toward God, to obey his laws. But we have to think and plan, and we don't want to run into slavery. We want to be able to obey the civil laws, use the laws of man wherever possible. But I look at America and I say, well, okay, you gave up slavery, you had a civil war, you gained your independence, and some of these things were intertwined, some are a bit different in the story, I realize that. But they broke away and did what they thought was right, and they set an interesting example to the world. I'm not sure how God will write up the Pax Americana in, say, two or three centuries' time from now. Looking back, I'm not sure how it'll be written up. I think it'll be written up like all civilizations, with great failings, whether it was Greek, Roman, British, Egyptian, Babylonian, or American. I suspect they're all going to have great flaws. And so for us in the church, I want to be able to look at our lives and say, I'm trying not to do the wrong thing, but I'm trying to be subject to God, a slave to God, but not to man. And it's a fine line I walk in terms of working that out. Let me finish up with a scripture in the book of James. You can read Romans 12, where it says, don't be conformed to this world. Let's try and think what God would have us do, but we're living in the world. But in particular, I want to read James 2 and verse 5. And this seems to me to, as it were, wrap it all up for what we suffer. James 2 and verse 5 says, listen, my beloved brethren, hasn't God chosen the poor of this world to be rich in the faith? Isn't that sort of where we come into the story? Isn't that a bit of where we're about? Some of us do quite well. Look, there are members in the church who are millionaires. I mean, there aren't lots of them, but there are some. There are people that will own a home, and you could, if you had a nice suburb and you owned a home, you could conceivably be at least half a millionaire, or a quarter of a millionaire, or three quarters of a millionaire. But if you owned a farm or a property, you could be a millionaire. That's not so difficult. There are people like that. But by and large, we're just ordinary people. Hasn't God chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith, to be heirs of the kingdom which he has promised to those that love him? If you are subject to God and you're growing in this direction, isn't there a great promise about where all this is going? Because if it isn't going somewhere, we're wasting our time. We really are in bondage. But verse 6 is the cap to the whole thing. But you have despised the poor. That's the problem with people. They get greedy. And in the church, we have to not do that. We have to maintain the correct status toward people. And then it gives you the real truth. It says, do not rich men oppress you. Do not rich men oppress you. Isn't that what history actually tells you? I know they've got their favorites. I know they give big gifts to their friends. But doesn't history actually tell you that the rich man oppresses you and draws you before the judgment seat? Isn't that what history tells you? And I think it is. I think that is the story of history. And I think that's the difficulty. And I think that's why, essentially, I still see us being in the grips of slavery. I don't see us as being independent and free. I see us using the words, talking the talk, but living in a culture where we're not as free as we'd like to be. I look forward then to the kingdom of God. I look forward to a time when we'll be free in a different sense. I hope that by paying attention to detail with our lives, we can avoid some of the slavery of this world, that we can serve our fellow man, that we can obey God, but we don't have to be completely, totally entrenched in slavery of this world. One day I hope that we will all sit back and enjoy the fruit of our own vines, and we'll enjoy the benefits of our own ground and land, which is owned without mortgage, free and titled to us. A slave to God, yes, but not to this world. And I believe ultimately all God actually asks for and wants are free sons. I don't believe God wants slaves. He wants a free-born son who voluntarily wants to be with him. Not someone who is bound to him as a slave, but a free son. That, with God, would be to me real independence.